Take the next case.
Case number 12-5173. Enrique Acosta, appellant, versus Michael G. Nelson, doctor, and Betsy Hernandez-Rykoff, doctor. Ms. Ando for the amicus curiae, Ms. Kidwell for the appellees.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Zando, we're ready.
May it please the court. The district court erred in granting summary judgment to appellees in this instance because there is a material issue of fact as to whether appellees intentionally interfered with the treatment prescribed to Acosta. Specifically, they intentionally interfered by exceeding the scope of their authority under the relevant BOP regulations and overruling the medical determination by the URC to grant Acosta surgery.
Why does the BOP regulations make any difference in this case?
Well, under former Farmer v. Moritsugu, that case indicates that there is constitutional protection under qualified immunity in circumstances where...
We're not talking about qualified immunity right now.
Understood.
At least not yet.
Well, the answer is that with respect to acting outside of regulations that are constitutional, that action, to the extent that it amounts to intentional interference in prescribed course of treatment under Estelle, would constitute a Bivens violation.
Well, interference with the prescribed course of treatment is not enough under Estelle. There has to be deliberate indifference. So the question is this serious enough, and is there deliberate indifference? But it may be that violating the regulations can be some indication of recklessness, but you still have to get to the point that the actual decision-making by the two doctors involved in this case itself violated Estelle, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's exactly the reason why summary judgment is not warranted here, because there's been no discovery that would permit us to actually investigate why it is that they...
Did you ask for discovery?
He did not. I don't know that he actually had the opportunity. Now,
he had a notice from the court, I think, on January 13th, 2010, alerting him that he needed to... how he needed to respond to a summary judgment motion and needed to...
I believe that he did that by attempting to put in an affidavit that he, I assume, believed actually addressed the issues that were before the court. However, it's not clear to me at all that Mr. Acosta, as a pro se litigant, had any idea that he had the right to request actual documentary discovery, for example.
Well, the notice refers to depositions and interrogatories.
I can't get myself inside Mr. Acosta's head, so I can't specifically answer as to why it is that he did not respond with specific discovery demands and only with an affidavit. I can say that certainly from the perspective of a practitioner, that what the court would have wanted to know, in my view, would be, for example, what exactly the record was that was before Mr. Nelson and Ms. Rykoff Hernandez.
I understand that, but that's true of any litigant. We have been pretty careful to help pro ses. We have the Fox notice requirement. Both the government and the district court provided the Fox notice. We've never held that you have to go beyond, even further beyond that. Unless you can give some case which is, we have cases that say if you don't ask for discovery, that's the end of your claim about discovery. You can still argue the other argument you have about a genuine issue of material fact, but you can't keep arguing discovery. Are there any cases that say that, for example, a pro se defendant has to be expressly told and not only and you take depositions, but you should ask for one. Is there anything like that?
I don't believe there's anything that requires that level of hand-holding per se. Mm-hmm. And so I think past a certain point, it's also incumbent upon the district court in evaluating the evidence to acknowledge when the evidence is just not there. So one of the issues here, and maybe I can take a step back, is when you look at the district court's decision, it would appear that what actually happened was the district court assumed in its decision that the appellees had the authority to prescribe treatment for Acosta. Under the BOP regulations, that's actually not the case. So the 11th Circuit actually got this right when they overturned the dismissal of Acosta's complaint. The 11th Circuit was very explicit. They said that the case that Acosta had made out was that the reversal of the URC determination was in fact where the Bivens claim lay. In granting summary judgment to the government in the district here, the court stated that the reason why the deliberate indifference standard was not met under Bivens was specifically because the medical assessment itself, there was nothing in the record that indicated that the assessment that was made by the two defendants was improper. I submit that that's actually the not the correct question to be asking in this circumstance. The correct question that should have been asked was whether or not the interference in the URC's decision was sufficient to raise a material question of fact as to whether a Bivens claim had occurred.
Well, was it really interference? I mean, you have the decision of the local committee, but then someone still has to move this prisoner and say that they should be designated for a different facility. And so why wasn't that exactly what they're supposed to do, and you just mechanically have to have happen in the national prison system?
Well, it's interesting, and I will fully admit that this did not come up until the opposition in the appeal for the first time. So it turns out that the regulation that the court relied on at the district court level was this P6031.01 patient care. Now, that particular regulation expressly applies only to the prisons themselves. So in other words, the URC is the final word with respect to that regulation. The government, in opposition, pointed to a different regulation, this P6270.01. Now, under that regulation, there are a number of different ways by which the OMD is permitted to reevaluate before a transfer is finally approved. However, a reevaluation of that medical condition that caused the request in the first place isn't one of those factors. So in terms of going ahead and reevaluating Acosta's condition, they actually engaged in something that was not called for or mandated under the regulation.
Before we even get to that, do you procedurally concede that we can consider that aspect of the government's argument, since it wasn't raised below? It appears for the first time here.
Well,
as part of trying to figure out how someone made a decision earlier?
I mean, I think we have to, because because I think that the issue actually wasn't framed correctly at the district court level, I feel that in order to properly resolve this issue here, we do need to consider what it was that they were actually supposed to be doing when they reviewed the transfer request. And to the extent that wasn't part of the record down below, that seems to be something that's required in order to reach resolution here.
Could I ask you to focus on, there's two defendants here, right?
Yes.
Can we go defendant by defendant? Because I think that's the only way I'm going to understand what the genuine issue of material fact is.
Sure.
All right. So if we look first at Dr. Nelson,
mm-hmm.
Okay, the document in which he does what could be called, what you would allege is a deliberate indifference, is A-126, right? It's the September 6th memorandum. Is that right? That's the only evidence you have that he did anything at all, but in particular that he did anything wrong, correct?
Well, that and also the affidavit that he put in.
Well, the affidavit refers to what he did in that memorandum.
Okay.
So that memorandum says, your request is denied. Per the chief health HSD, please provide a description of his functional limitations. Has he been stable or getting worse? Well, that looks like what he's saying is your request for the transfer is denied and I want more information, right?
Sure.
That's all. That's all he did so far. So is a request, is an immediate request, a request for an immediate transfer with an inquiry into more information. Does that sound like deliberate indifference? How can we say that when a doctor says, well, I'm not going to grant this request, but I want more information, that shows deliberate indifference?
It it certainly can in a circumstance where he wasn't actually authorized to ask those questions in the first place. In other words, to the extent that his denial is going to be predicated on his medical condition, which no regulation permits him to actually deny it based on, is the question itself, the substance of it doesn't really matter. I mean, and truthfully, even if you look at the question in and of itself,
I don't follow that at all. The request that he's referring to is Tangalik's request, right? That's the one dated July 12th.
I actually am not sure that that's correct. Because it would appear that when the URC actually approved the request, there was a packet that was sent on. Tangulik's request may have been part of that packet. I don't know that the record is actually complete with respect to what was in front of Mr. Nelson.
Assume that you can't get any more evidence. Assume that because there was no request for discovery, we only have what's before us.
Okay.
In his affidavit, he refers to a request dated July 12th. Is there another request dated July 12th besides Tangulik's?
Not that's in the record, Your Honor. Right.
And that is not a request for treatment. That is a request being referred for further evaluation and treatment, right?
Yes.
So all we have him doing here is saying, the request for further evaluation and treatment is denied. Please give me more information.
Yes. However,
that doesn't sound like
deliberate indifference. Well, here's the problem. So if you go to 837, which is the Regional Administrative Remedy Appeal Number 42048-R1 Part B response. What it actually says is the request that was before Nelson wasn't Tangulig's analysis per se. It was actually that it says, an inquiry revealed on June 5, 2006, your case was reviewed by the Regional Utilization Review Committee, Regional Health Systems Administrator, and Regional Medical Director. Your arm deformity is the result of an injury that took place in 1984. This is a long-standing injury that will require extensive surgery and post-surgical rehabilitation. In order to best enhance your care and preserve security, your care is best rendered at a federal medical center. Accordingly, the warden's response to your administrative remedy request is correct. In accordance with program statement 6270.01, a transfer request was sent to the Office of Medical Designations in the central office. So that's actually what Nelson and Hernandez-Rikoff were reviewing. It was the transfer request. Now, whether Dr. Tangulig's recommendation was part of that packet, I don't know, and that's not in front of this court. However, because what was actually in front of them was a transfer request, under the transfer request regulation, they did not have the right to re-diagnose Acosta and decide that the surgery was inappropriate.
What? Where does it say that in the regulation?
It doesn't say it anywhere, and that's exactly the point.
What does it say they can't consider?
Because the regulation with respect to patient care is very clear that the URC is the top of the chain when it comes to determining what care is appropriate for these prisoners. So when the URC approved his request for medical treatment and put in for a transfer, there may have been many reasons why, including lack of bed availability, that the OMD could have denied that transfer request, but they didn't do that. They denied the request based on a reevaluation of his medical condition, and that's not authorized.
Where does it say what they're supposed to consider in deciding whether to transfer? I just see, maybe you have another place to point me, I just see on page 7 of the government's addendum to the red brief that the medical designator will review each request and approve or deny the requested transfer, but that doesn't seem to limit.
Sure. So if you go to I have it as the addendum to the government's opposition brief, page 2 of 13.
Is this in the joint appendix somewhere?
No, it's not. The government submitted it on.
It's the one attached to the government's brief.
Yes.
Okay. And can you tell me what page of that it's on?
Sure. I want to start at the top of page 2 of 13 of that particular appendix.
Okay. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. So if you look at designation considerations, which is number 5, there are a number of different opportunities that the government has to decide that they're not going to permit the transfer. However, if you look at them, for brevity, I'm just going to read the headers. Length of stay is one of them. If you look to the next page, next one is available community resources, medical resources directory, medical risk and transport, comorbidities, case management, and cost of treatment.
Well, why isn't available community resources? Because what they have to decide there is, can this be the local folks said you got a problem that needs to be treated. And as I read available community resources, it says, can the local folks deal with this with the medical resources they have where this prisoner is, so we don't need to redesignate and move this person. And so inherent is going to be some assessment of what the nature of the medical status is, and can it be treated there versus here? And the ultimate determination was it can be treated there with painkillers.
Well, yes, except that that required them to overrule the URC's determination that surgery was required, and that's under the other regulation. And that's not, that's actually not permissible as far as I understand it under the BOP regs.
Why isn't it, if there are sufficient resources to handle a medical condition, why is that not a capacity to decide what resources need to you need to have to handle a medical condition?
Sure. Well, I can say this. First of all, the assumption underlying that is that the diagnosis of surgery was unnecessary. So that in and of itself is challenging the URC. I'd also point out that under Blackstone, which is admittedly not a D.C. Circuit case, but the government relies on it, it points out that there is value in terms of determining the seriousness of a medical condition with respect to whether or not a physician has diagnosed the condition. So I'd submit that the URC's determination that surgery was required in this particular circumstance would be just such a diagnosis.
And where do you find a determination that surgery is required by the URC?
Well, the URC's, I don't have the URC's actual document itself in the record, but I would say that it says that the going back to page 37, it says it will require extensive surgery and post-surgical rehabilitation.
But that's true, that seems, everybody seems to agree that he had an injury that caused a gross deformity, and if you're going to fix that, it takes surgery. But that's not saying that it has to be done today, or that it has to be done now, or anything like that. And I'm still stuck with the doctor saying, your request is denied, get me more information. There's nothing in URC or anybody else's thing that says this had to be done immediately.
And I don't think that we're submitting that it did need to be done immediately. Well, the fact is that
did,
it wasn't done at all.
Well, that's fine, but we only have two defendants here.
Sure.
And one of the defendants is Nelson, and he left soon after.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say that. It would be one thing if he had been there for the next 10 years, and he can continue to deny and say no, et cetera.
Right.
But this is a one-time shot. Your request is denied. Give me more information. That's all this guy is responsible for, nothing, right? There's
right.
Nothing else.
Right.
So the question is a doctor asking for more information where no one has told him it has to be done now, is that deliberate indifference at the level at which Estelle asks?
I would say that certainly of the two defendants, that would be the weaker of the two defendants, yeah. In terms of that. I don't, here's
one way, can I ask a question?
Sure.
This way? So suppose that the same document we're looking at, which is that A-126, has everything in it as is, but it doesn't have your request is denied. So all we know is that he's asking for more information.
Right.
I mean, as I understand your argument, he wasn't even permitted to do that because he's just
revoking true.
Considerations that he's not even supposed to be looking at.
That's correct. Although I certainly agree with the panel if this is what they're insinuating that with respect to Dr.
Just
Nelson.
Just asking. We'll ask hard questions to the other side. Don't worry.
That the case with respect to Dr. Nelson is substantially weaker than it is with respect to Dr. Hernandez-Rikoff. Now, I will also say, yes, you're right. If he didn't deny the request, while it's outside the regulations to ask for additional information with respect to his condition, I wouldn't say that in and of itself rises to the level of deliberate indifference.
Is it out? Because the first page of the regulation attached to their brief
mm-hmm.
Identifies urgency of need and cost effectiveness as both things that the designator can consider. So was it really outside Dr. Nelson's ability to say, I want more information as part of deciding urgency of need, at least? Let's see how limited the guy is.
I would say that if you take the suggestion that the request is denied part out of it and was merely asking for additional information, I'm certainly not going to put myself into Dr. Nelson's head and try to figure out why it is that he was asking for that additional information. His affidavit is not clear with respect to what it was that triggered him to ask for that additional information in the first place. It's pretty perfunctory.
Mm-hmm.
So, assuming that I'm still under the strictures that Judge Garland requested, which is that I have no further discovery to get into in this, the answer is, in and of itself, asking that question is not.
I mean, I get your point. It certainly seems a bit backwards to say, no, now give me information, as opposed to let me give information and then I'll decide something. When he said no, now give me more information, did that actually mean no, or was it kind of a temporary no until I get more information? You didn't have to go back and start the process all over again, so it really was a hang on, nothing right now, let me get information.
And it's really hard for me to know. I mean, I guess to turn it back a little bit, you know, I would say, the problem that we have here is we had two different individuals that inserted themselves into this process. And, you know, if it was one single individual that sent both memorandums, I think it would be a clearer case. I think with respect to the fact that the first one came from Dr. Nelson, it makes the case against Dr. Nelson weaker.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'm over my allotted time.
Well, let me just ask about the other. Go ahead.
The other person.
Yeah.
Please.
Other person.
Yeah.
So that one is Dr. Hernandez Rikoff, correct?
Correct.
And that document is A129. Right? The September 24th memo?
Yes.
And at that point, there is now an addendum on Tangle Leagues.
Mm-hmm.
In which he now, in September, saw the patient, I take it again, and it says he still has the same degree of limitations. The range of motion is free from 90 to 135 degrees. He continues to be the pitcher on a softball team. He uses an effective arm to throw the ball. His team won the tournament this summer. I'm not sure that's medical analysis, but it seems clear that this doctor is trying to imply something. He has the same functional problems with his right hand elbow since 1983, since the accident of 1983. He has a good grip in both hands. The use of his right hand is limited by his inability to fully extend and flex the elbow. Now, assume just for the moment that Dr. Hernandez Rikoff actually has authority to consider these things.
Sure.
I appreciate your point that she doesn't, but assume that she does. Would it then be deliberately indifference to deny a referral after having seen that?
Yes. Potentially. I mean, it really depends on what her intent was. And that's exactly the issue with respect to deliberate indifference, is that because it's subjective, that her intent matters. And
I understand you. You think that in the depositions she's going to say, I admit I was deliberately indifferent? Well, when you say that, yes, it's subjective, but it has to be determined from circumstantial evidence.
Understood, although I would say that with respect to
and she said in her declaration, I denied that request based upon available medical information indicating that limitations in inmate Acosta's range of motion were not affecting his activities. So the only evidence in the record with respect to her subjective intent is her declaration. Mm-hmm. Again, put aside your request for discovery. So now I'm asking you to put aside two things. One, her request for discovery, and two, the question of whether she had authority as a doctor to consider these things. Mm-hmm. Assuming that she did and that there's nothing else, we have a doctor who is looking at the visit that another doctor has recorded, which that other doctor has indicated that the person's condition is not getting any worse. It's been the same since 1983, which was itself 10 years before he went to jail, and that he's the pitcher on the softball team, and he won the tournament, and he's got mobility. So is it deliberate indifference at that point to say, well, we're not going to give treatment then?
Well,
we're certainly not going to, we're not going to give surgery anyway.
Here's at risk of being impertinent, I'm going to throw a question back, which is, you know,
you got to understand, I don't have to answer these
questions. Was it really appropriate for her to make that determination without knowing more than simply what Dr. Tangulik had to say with respect to his condition based on second examination? For example, Natalie Pelt put in an affidavit in support of summary judgment in which she indicated that inmate Acosta was seen by medical no less than 19 times between October of 2003 and September of 2007. He also visited a chronic pain clinic, I believe it was six times, between 2005 and 2009. Now, Dr. Tangulig's opinion may be that it was the same since 1983, but he had no way of knowing that. 1983 is before Acosta was even incarcerated. He didn't arrive at Mariana until 2006. He was at Jessup in 2005 when Dr. Hine made the initial diagnosis. So, you know, and yes, it's, I don't know whether Dr. Hernandez-Rieckhoff was aware of all this information or not.
Or any of it. Yeah.
But it would seem to me that she should have known all of that before she denied his request.
Well, even so, that's, if that, the words you've just used, you've used two sets of words,
mm-hmm.
that unless you modify those words, you're finished. Should have, that's at best negligence, and Estelle expressly says negligence is not deliberate indifference. And then you said not appropriate, something like that. Again, that is not reckless disregard.
But
so you got to get further than that.
Well, but you get there if reasonably she should have requested that information and reviewed it.
Only if to not do it is deliberate indifference rather than negligence. Estelle specifically says that medical malpractice is not covered by the Eighth Amendment and that medical negligence is not covered.
Agreed. And medical malpractice would be, in my view, if she had merely looked at the full record that was available with respect to Mr. Acosta, which is substantially more than what's before this court or what's been discussed in this case, and made a thorough evaluation of whether or not Dr. Tangulig's quick assessment of him was really accurate.
So
but no, there was more. I'm sorry.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
She know there was more information she had.
Not clear from the record whether.
Then again, I think you have to have a record to find deliberate indifference.
Well, and
she didn't know. We can't blame her for not asking.
And thus I'm kind of stuck in a secular argument, because part of the problem that I've got with this is that what I see from the record is that Dr. Hernandez-Rieckhoff was a single practitioner who had no access to Mr. Acosta herself, who never examined him herself, who had apparently very limited access to records, or at least chose to have limited access to records when she made this decision, is overruling a panel, a committee that includes doctors that had actual access to examine Mr. Acosta. In other words, the URC, which includes these doctors that are actually in Mariana. So what she did as a single practitioner was she overruled a committee whose express purpose was to determine whether or not surgery was the appropriate remedy.
Where's the committee's, you gave us the first one, 837, well, do we have the committee anywhere? How do we know what the committee said?
Well, all we know about what the committee said from the record is what's at 837.
But that was before Nelson even acted, right?
That was before Nelson acted, because typically, as I understand the BOP regulations, once the URC determines that the transfer is required, the request goes forward, and at that point, the URC is no longer involved in the process.
So was there a second request to her? I mean, in other words...
No. What appears to have happened is after Dr. Nelson's request for more information, Dr. Tangulig's addendum was added, mm-hmm. and then that same request was put on Hernandez-Rieckhoff's desk. Once again, I'm actually surmising, because the record itself isn't entirely clear as to this, but that would seem to be what happened here.
Sounds like you think Dr. Tangulig had a reckless disregard and deliberate indifference. Is that right?
No, because the issue in front of the court isn't whether or not he needed the surgery. The question is whether the denial of the transfer was appropriate. And Dr. Tangulig really wasn't the person who had the authority to decide to transfer.
Well, if he didn't need the surgery, then it could not have been deliberate indifference to deny the transfer.
Well, I mean, I guess my response is that Dr. Tangulig's second opinion was really unnecessary and should not have been considered in the course of deciding whether or not the transfer should be granted.
You're only allowed to consider the first doctor, not the second doctor.
No, you're supposed to only consider the assessment of the URC as a whole, which was the entire record up to the point when Dr. Nelson received it.
So it'd be a deliberate indifference for the government to ask for a second opinion after that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the government
yeah.
did ask for a second opinion, because the URC is that second opinion.
So
what the URC is supposed to do is take Dr. Tangulig's original analysis plus Dr. Hine's original consultation request and look at it and critically analyze whether or not this treatment is required. That's exactly what the URC is there for. The OMD isn't there to make
Still,
that determination.
Now you're talking about whether they followed regulations or not. I'm asking whether they violated the Eighth Amendment. Is it a violation of the Eighth Amendment for someone to ask for another opinion from the doctor who saw him before, which is what happened here? Is that itself a violation of the Eighth Amendment to ask for another opinion? That's what you just said.
No, asking for information in and of itself is not a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Okay, so then proceeding to take that second opinion, value it over the reasoned opinion of the URC, and then taking that as a predicate to deny care where that particular issue, in other words, whether or not the medical condition was sufficiently serious or not, was not part of the correct analysis for them to be making in deciding to transfer or not transfer. That's where it occurs.
We don't have the reasoned decision of the URC, right?
We do not.
So we don't know whether it's reasoned or not.
That would be correct.
And would your argument apply even if Acosta himself had a friend who was a physician or something and got an opinion from that friend? It's outside the URC process.
Right.
But, and then that comes to light to the attention of Hernandez-Rikoff.
I think that the view is that irrespective of what other opinions there are, that the reason why the policies are the way that they are is because the URC is supposed to be the final determination.
So you just can't look at anything else at all.
That's right. At that point they are constrained, and to the extent that they wish to deny transfer, that there are many opportunities they have to do so, but reevaluation of the medical condition is not one of them.
And a couple other questions. Is there anything that would prevent him, or maybe he already has, contacting his local medical folks and starting this process again, showing that, I mean, he's been on these painkillers now for, is it 7 years when they did this? Right, and so, I mean, but has he done another round of saying, hey, it's not working, here's my functional limitations,
On the record, I just don't know.
We don't know anything
We don't know anything about what's happened to him in the intervening time period since the summary judgment motion, and with respect to the medical records themselves.
But nothing in the decision here would preclude him if the stuff really isn't working, if his functional limitations are getting worse from bringing a new claim through the process.
I don't believe that would be the case. Yeah, I think he would be able to do that.
Can I just clarify one thing? Do you read the complaint as asking for injunctive relief or not?
So, I don't know. And I say this, you know, despite the fact that I've reread this complaint endless times, and I really don't know the answer to that. I know that he cites to Bivens in the complaint, and so it's clear that a Bivens action is being asked for. In this particular case, I tend to agree with the government that the better remedy here would actually be to just have the procedure done as opposed to looking for monetary damages. It would just make life a lot easier for everyone and actually resolve the substance of the issue that caused the suit in the first place. My view is that this court could read injunctive relief into his complaint as a pro se litigant. Do I think that it's explicit? No, I don't.
I thought, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was there an original complaint that had asked for the surgery, essentially injunctive relief?
Yeah.
And then there was an amended one.
And the amended one was, yeah. I mean,
didn't say that, but then someone said, hey, what do you want? And didn't he then attach his original?
He did. I mean, well, so.
Isn't that enough to put
And the government told me, and it wasn't clear to me from the record that I received when I started working on this case, that the attachments to his original complaint actually weren't attached to his amended complaint either. So it's not clear to me whether he thought that the original complaint and the amended complaint basically acted as a single document or not. I think that it's colorable, certainly, that he was seeking injunctive relief when he originally filed the claim. I would certainly, you know, stepping out of his personal shoes and into court-appointed amicus shoes, I would certainly advocate that would probably be the best result.
Thank you.
What are the implications of that? Is that only a remedy question? Does that change the substantive standard? I assume if he's asking for injunctive relief, it has to be some kind of ex parte Young argument, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that ultimately it's going to change the standard, because at the end of the day, as I understand it, and this issue really wasn't briefed before the court, so I would say to the extent that the court is seriously considering it, I'd ask for supplemental briefing on that narrow issue. But my understanding would be that I still need to be able to somehow or another establish that there has been a violation of the Constitution in order to be able to get that relief.
And both of these doctors are either of these doctors still in charge of the, one of the doctors is no longer in charge of the transfer?
They are not. And so one of the issues, and I noticed this in the case law as well, is that it's difficult to ask for injunctive relief when you're suing individuals, because if they're no longer in that position, you can't actually force them to engage in certain courses of conduct.
That's what happened in Maleska, right?
They
were the prison defendant official was no longer there, and the court said under those circumstances damages is the only thing you could get, because
right.
They're no longer can effectuate an injunction.
Right. I mean, I also think that that there could be, you know, and I struggled with this, that the problem with it is that you can't order these specific two defendants to do it. Can we substitute another defendant and then convert it purely into a claim for injunctive relief? Possibly. I don't know who that defendant would be.
Why wouldn't it be an APA action against the Bureau of Prisons?
It might be. I mean, and you know,
then you have a totally different legal standard.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and I think that all of those are distinct possibilities. I struggle a little bit at the moment discussing this with the court, just because it's very far outside the scope of what the briefs actually had. I would say, and then I will, I'll let the government speak. I would say that to the extent that the court is interested in trying to find a practical resolution to this problem, that's certainly the right track with respect to this, as opposed to the Bivens claim itself. And that, to the extent that the court's interested in that, the supplemental briefing would be the appropriate way to handle it.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Judith Kidwell, and I represent Dr. Nelson's and Dr. Hernandez-Rykoff. A few things I'd like to clear up for the court initially is that there is no evidence that any URC ever approved any surgery for Mr. Acosta. In fact, I have gone back to BOP on a number of issues, finding out what the current status is, and asked that very question, given the fact that both Mr. Acosta and Amicus had asserted that position.
Can I back up and ask a procedural question? Your brief argued that we're not bound by law of the case from the 11th Circuit decision based on an extraordinary circumstances doctrine. And is it your position that is the what we would have to find to not apply law of the case?
Your Honor, what we were redoing was responding to the Amicus's position, but the court really doesn't need to address that because the district court did not dismiss this action under 12b-6 and, in fact, granted summary judgment. And so that analysis is really not necessary. We were really just responding to what the Amicus had put in the brief. What I would like to advise the court is that there's no...
Did you make the affirmative argument that law of the case doesn't apply because it's a new procedural stage?
No, Your Honor, we were
so
not.
So is that waived?
No, we are not waiving that.
If it's not in your brief, isn't it waived?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You said you didn't make the legal argument that law of the case doesn't apply because summary judgment is different than 12b-6. But you didn't make that argument. Is that a waivable argument? All you argued was the extraordinary circumstances.
Yes.
So I'm trying to figure out if I disagree that this is an extraordinary circumstances situation, if one were to do that, would we then have to say that law of the case governs? Because you didn't argue this other explanation for escaping law of the case.
What's before the court is the grant of the summary judgment motion by the district court.
Right, and one of the arguments they said is that was improper because of law of the case.
Yes.
And your only answer was extraordinary circumstances.
No. What our argument is that the court did not, the law of the case would only have applied had the district court, dismissed the case. The district court instead granted the alternative motion to grant summary judgment. And in fact, the cases that the amicus has cited, in many of those cases, what did occur is that only a motion under 12b-6 was filed, and the court converted without any notice whatsoever to the plaintiff.
Just to be clear, so your first argument is the 11th Circuit's irrelevant because they decided only on a motion to dismiss.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you have on page 15, Amicus also argues that the doctor's motion to dismiss was improper because of the law of the case.
Yes.
But you're not relying anymore on... You're not really relying on the motion to dismiss. You're relying only on it being summary.
A motion for summary judgment,
right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So basically, pages 15 to 17 of your brief are sort of irrelevant for our purposes. Is that right?
There's
no argument here about, you don't think that the court in this case, could have dismissed under a motion to dismiss, right, under 12b-6. You don't think the district court could have done that, given what the 11th Circuit did?
If the court had found extraordinary circumstances, I believe the court could.
But are you relying that on appeal?
We are relying on the grant of summary judgment, Your Honor.
Okay.
I thought what was going on was that they had made the argument that the motion was inappropriately converted from a motion to dismiss to one for summary judgment. And then you only get to the 11th Circuit law of the case question if you think that it was inappropriately converted, because then it's a dismissal case. And then the 11th Circuit's disposition as to dismissal would be law of the case as to dismissal.
Relevant.
But your position was you never get to that question because it wasn't inappropriately converted in the first place, so this is a summary judgment case.
That's correct.
Is that the, okay.
So if there was no URC decision, how did this get to the two defendants?
Your Honor, there are two procedures here that go on as far as medical care with BOP. You have the local level, the facility level, where the clinical director is overseeing the health and doctors at the local level. Then you have Mr. Acosta filing various administrative remedies. And what A37, in fact, is doing here is not in any way opining that the URC has approved this. In fact, what it's really doing here is just describing the situation that an inquiry has been made
the next phrase says your case was reviewed by the Regional Utilization Review Committee.
Yes, your case was reviewed. It does not say that it was approved. It says that it was reviewed.
So have you found in your efforts whether there was actually a review? When you told us that there was no evidence that they ever approved, are you including that there's no evidence they ever reviewed, or there is evidence that they reviewed?
There's evidence that they reviewed even as early as 2003 and maintained that the conservative treatment that was being given to Mr. Acosta was appropriate.
Well, there's also a transfer request, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the transfer request comes from him or from the committee?
It came from the warden, Your Honor. If you look at the facts of the case, what's happening here, and the amicus points this out in her brief, is there's parallel requests going on. Mr. Acosta has been filing administrative remedies. He's appealing those. A37 is actually a denial, and the very last sentence there says that we're denying it. But they're advising Mr. Acosta, by the way, though, there has been a transfer request made to Washington to see if they will transfer you to a medical facility.
Right, so, would anyone have done that if there wasn't actually if the committee just reviewed but didn't decide that some sort of advanced medical treatment was needed beyond what they could provide locally? Would you ever get to this stage?
Could you repeat your
question? I'm just trying to figure out if there was no specific determination by the committee that he needed something, i.e. surgery, that had to be done somewhere else, you wouldn't get a warden putting in transfers, and you wouldn't get this medical designation determination process even initiated, would you?
Your Honor, I'm not certain that that's true, but that's what the record reflects. And it may have been because Mr. Acosta was asking the question. It may have been because of the recommendation that had been made to see whether or not he could be transferred. But there is not anything in the record showing that there was this committee meeting. And in fact, the clinical director, as the record does show, had denied that consultation request just a few months after Dr. Hine had made that recommendation.
Would a committee decision normally be given to an inmate? The content of the decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
The decision itself, as opposed to a bottom line, here's what they decided. They would actually give whatever the content of these decisions are.
Okay. Yes.
Who's the regional director, CRO? What does that mean? On A37, SERO, regional director, SERO. The person who signed A37, what is that person's job?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Is it a doctor? Is it a warden? We don't know anything. You don't know anything like that?
It's the regional committee, but I can't answer.
Regional
that
director,
question.
It's a regional director.
Yes. I can't answer whether he's a physician or not.
I see. Okay. Could you address the position of opposing counsel that given the regulations starting on page 2 of your addendum that the two defendants had no authority to consider any medical issue other than the one specifically listed there in deciding whether to grant or deny the transfer?
Your Honor, first of all, I'd like to point out that this program statement was cited in Mr. Acosta's complaint. It was cited in his initial complaint and in the amended complaint. So to suggest it wasn't in the record, the fact that a copy of it was not in the record does not mean that it is not in the record, just like cases that he cited as well.
Well, they're using it against you. They're using it against you, so very nice that you're willing to concede it's in the record. Now you've gotten them halfway there. Now, how about the other half?
Your Honor, under the BOP regulations, in order to transfer a patient, there are certain factors that are looked at under the regulations. There has to be a decision whether or not the urgency of the need, and of course, in order to determine whether there's an urgency of need, you have to find out what is going on with the inmate, how serious.
Which is the section that talks about urgency of need?
The very first section, the purpose and scope. The medical designator makes designations, referrals, and denials based upon.
What page are you on? Sorry.
Very first page of the end.
Yes, on the very first page.
Ah, okay, thanks.
So in order to make this decision, first of all, they have to find out. There is the other regulation which was cited in the district court on patient care. It establishes certain levels for inmates.
That's not the medical designator. Doesn't decide that.
No, but it certainly would be relevant, Your Honor, as far as whether or not what was being looked at was an elective procedure versus a patient that was in an emergency situation.
We don't know which level was attached to this because we don't have the actual committee decision. Who would attach the level B or C to him, his condition? Who would make that first cut as to which level he's at, B or C?
Well, certainly that would be looked at as to whether or not you're going to transfer a patient or not.
So is someone going to make a first cut? Because that's in a different regulation,
it is.
Right? So my assumption was that the committee or local folks on the ground would be the ones who would decide B or C.
The clinical director, the doctors would be looking at that. The very doctors that sent the referral form for, they would also be including information which addresses these very things, the urgency of the need, in order to find out whether or not you've got to transfer someone.
Are the two defendants medical designators under the meaning of this rule?
Yes, Your Honor. And one, Dr. Nelson was there initially, and then Dr. Hernandez-Rykoff was actually in an acting position for only about a month. She's no longer with BOP. Dr. Nelson is currently in Rochester.
But they were both they were both accurately described as medical designators.
Yes. I will also tell the court that in speaking with, as far as Mr. Acosta's current condition, what I was able to find out, is that since 2008, and that's when the records were made electronic, there's only two mentions of his arm in his medical records.
Now we're way outside the record.
We are, but I wanted to advise the court that having asked the amicus that I had checked in to see where we were on that.
Can I just ask a question about these? So I may be looking at something that's irrelevant here, but on page 5 of the same document, under types of medical designations, is this irrelevant, the initial designations? Then it says the following information must be considered before making initial medical
yes.
designation.
The he end. Would have been a redesignation.
He's a redesignation.
He's already at a facility.
And so you don't take into account, even though it says you take into account the inmate's medical needs with respect to the initial designation, there's...
Well, it indicates that redesignations are initiated for inmates with acute medical, surgical, or psychiatric conditions, or for those who have chronic needs. And this language, if you'll look at the other BOP regulation, mirrors the various levels that are set forth for the for providing care to inmates. It's provided on a priority basis, depending on their seriousness.
The one thing that sort of raises a question in my mind is that there doesn't seem to be any dispute by anybody, medical designator or committee, that he has not just pain but functional limitations. Softball or no, everyone agrees he's got limited range, the degrees of motion on his elbow, and that it's sort of a chronic condition, and the debridement reference suggests to me that it's a deteriorating condition. And so how can it ever be plausible for someone to say, when there's a determination of functional limitations, an inquiry into functional limitations, you take two aspirin and call me in the morning? Painkillers don't address functional limitations.
Your Honor, that's true. But again,
so they just ignore the whole functional limitation part.
Your Honor, I would, in making a decision about the priority of care for inmates, BOP unfortunately does have to make those decisions every day as far as who they can give an elective procedure to. I would suggest to the court that there are a number of inmates who could probably improve.
You're assuming it's elective, but we don't. Who made a determination that it was elective? Where's that in the record?
Again, if you look at the regulations, Your Honor, as far as the level's concerned, Mr. Acosta's condition clearly falls in level C. The other two conditions are emergency conditions. Level B discusses individuals with cancer, with hepatitis, who
I thought it had some orthopedic
had
issues in B as well. I'm not sure if you can remind me where level B is, but I thought there was some of the things listed for level B that were also could also apply here. Is that a disputed question of fact or not? Is that conceded by the other side that he's not in B?
Your Honor, the amicus raised level B, but then in her reply brief refers to level C and suggests we're outside the regulations. I think you would have to address that question to her, but I think if you look at the various levels, there is no way that Mr. Acosta's condition approaches a level
B. Where's the level
B?
A level B.
B says significant pain or discomfort which impairs the inmate's participation in activities of daily living.
What page is that for?
I think it's at 136.
Thank you. Right.
So, I take it their argument is that, I mean, you presumably disagree, but their argument is that that's him.
It also has significant reduction in the possibility of repair later without present treatment, and I believe he'd asserted that his arm was actually shrinking.
But there's no evidence, medical evidence of that, Your Honor.
There's no medical evidence either way. Maybe those are disputed facts. He asserts it.
Your Honor, and the fact that the inmate has argued a lot of things in the complaint or in his opposition.
Did he assert it in an affidavit?
Yeah, he's a piece.
Which, did he assert in an affidavit?
In his complaint, he argues.
I know he did it in the complaint.
In the complaint. In his declaration, Your Honor, he says nothing about the shrinking, and he says nothing about the pain. He does indicate that he is having difficulty using his right hand, not that it's useless, but that he's having difficulty using it to brush his teeth, to do certain
things
during the day.
Right, those sound like activities of daily living. But you all have to concede the pain. You all said painkillers was the remedy here. So I think it's, right, we're not going to dispute that he has pain and that he was in clinic repeatedly for pain, correct?
We do not dispute that he was receiving painkillers or that he was in pain, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. What that pain is necessarily from is not clear in the record. One of the things that is clear in the record is that Mr. Acosta was the pitcher on a softball team and was playing softball constantly and using the very arm and the very hand that has been injured. He also injured himself in a number of other ways. One time the ball hit his finger. That's also in the record. So was he in pain? Yes, but was he in pain from this long-standing injury or from what he was doing on a daily basis, such as playing softball or other activities, is not clear from the record.
Well, then why were they prescribing painkillers as conservative treatment if they didn't think he was in pain? It was described to be the conservative treatment for this condition,
yes,
not for the softball injury.
No, but
why were they I mean, this is odd then if they are ignoring the functional limitations. So he says he can't do daily living and they're prescribing painkillers if they don't think he's in pain, but he has a functional limitation.
He has a functional limitation. There's no question about that. It's a longstanding injury, and we don't argue that he has a functional limitation. What we do argue is that it rises to a serious medical need for Eighth Amendment purposes.
Can I ask one question, by the way? Is that a question of fact or law, whether something constitutes a sufficiently serious medical need for Eighth Amendment purposes?
It's a matter of law, Your Honor. And in this case, the cases talk about,
a lot of cases talk
whether
about
or not
facts.
Either the treatment has been mandated or whether a layperson, it would be obvious. And there is a difference between a medical condition being serious and a medical need being serious. In this case, it's the need that needs to be focused on. I don't think anybody disagrees that there's probably a gross deformity of his arm. There are gross deformities with scars. Anybody that's ever been in accidents, there are amputees in BOP. So many of them have what you might term serious medical conditions. But it's the medical need that is the focus of the Eighth Amendment. And that is whether or not he was at a substantial risk of harm, health-wise, without this treatment. And the evidence just does not support that in this case. The fact that you're functionally limited does not constitute a serious need under the Eighth Amendment.
Would you concede that something that falls within level C could, not that, just generally, not with respect to this case one way or the other, but something that falls within level C could trigger Eighth Amendment concerns? Is something in level C potentially sufficiently severe to trigger the Eighth Amendment?
It's generally, Your Honor, the way that it's defined is elective. And so what's going to happen is the time that it would trigger the Eighth Amendment analysis is when they had been improperly put, if you will, in a certain in the level C. In other words,
Didn't
I would suggest
Estelle
to you
suggest,
that
with its back pain, suggests that something like this could trigger Eighth Amendment concerns, an injury like this? Again, I'm not asking you to concede anything for this particular case and this particular record, but this type of injury could, under Estelle, trigger Eighth Amendment concerns if treated with deliberate indifference.
I think with certain medical evidence, it might be possible. I'm not a physician, and so it's difficult for me to answer that question in the vote. But I think what would be more likely is that you would have someone who was really in category A and B, and they were considered in C level, because the C level really is for elective type of procedures.
Further questions from the panel? Okay, I know you're out of time also. We'll let the plaintiff have 2 minutes. Let's try to keep it at 2 minutes.
Yeah. We would just ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed.
I guessed.
Thank you.
Can I just, now I'm going to waste some of your 2 minutes, maybe not waste it, but I have two questions.
Sure.
Is this declaration of Mr. Acosta at 8-22-238 the only declaration or affidavit that he submitted?
Yes. Yeah, and to go directly to that point with respect to level B, he certainly makes out a case that he is in fact a level B.
But there's no discussion of his arm shrinking or of pain or anything like that in this.
That's correct.
I thought the arm shrinkage had been one of his administrative appeals.
I think that's right.
But that's not part of this record?
It is part of this record, but it's not part. It just wasn't part of the sworn record that Mr. Acosta submitted. In other words, it's part that the entire package of documents is part of the government's case in summary judgment, with the exception, obviously, of the few pages that were attached to Mr. Acosta's complaint. But with respect to Mr. Acosta's opposition, he did not specifically submit that as part of his affidavit.
But it's in the record in this litigation, in the district court record?
Yeah.
Shrinking arm?
As far as I'm aware, the only time that Mr. Acosta has ever addressed his condition other than in his complaint is in that affidavit.
Can I ask one other question? What do you say about the response with respect to the program statement, the first page rather than the second page?
Mm-hmm.
It says the medical director makes designations and denials based on urgency of need.
It,
It says that, and that is, and they
but
certainly
before
are.
Before, when we were talking about this, this was not one of the things listed on page 2, and I had the impression you were saying they can only consider the things considered on page 2 to 3 under designation considerations. This suggests they can also consider urgency of need and bureau institution capabilities, among other things.
Well, while I wouldn't want to go too far into statutory interpretation or regulation or regulation interpretation, I would say that that section 1 is really a general purpose statement, and so while it's something that is in the background while considerations are being made, that with respect to what the criteria are that they're supposed to be considering and making determinations, those are laid out in section 5. I would also point out to the court, simply because it came up during the government's argument, that with respect to the URC and the fact that whether they actually made a determination or not, the 11th Circuit actually made a factual finding when they reversed the motion to dismiss that the URC did in fact rule that.
How could they have made a factual finding when all they were doing was ruling on 12b-6?
They had that document in front of them when they ruled on it because it was attached to Mr. Acosta's complaint. In other words, it was...
Which document? 837?
Sorry, yeah. 837 was attached to Mr. Acosta's complaint, and so the 11th Circuit considered it when they were looking at the motion to dismiss. And if you look at page 853, which is the 11th Circuit's decision, it expressly says, a panel comprised of the Regional Utilization Review Committee, Regional Health Systems Administrator, and Regional Medical Director reviewed Acosta's medical file and ruled that the deformity in Acosta's arm required extensive surgery and rehabilitation.
Well, how do we know that they, first of all, courts of appeals are not likely to make findings of fact, at least I never knew we had that authority, but it's nice to know. But second, that was something that was contained as an attachment to the complaint. So they're just saying, this is part of the allegations he's made, and if this is true, then we have to dismiss. But I don't see how the Court of Appeals could make a factual finding. They have nothing before them that's different than before us, and there was no summary judgment motion. There was no argument on the other side about that.
Well, I guess I would say that it's the same document that was in front of the district court, so when the factual findings were made at the district court level. So to the extent that...
Which district? Are you talking about the district court here in D.C.?
Yes. Yeah. So I really can't comment on what opposing counsel's investigation determined with respect to what documentation exists within the BOP at this point in time. But certainly with respect to this case, the URC's determination is something that has been considered to have actually occurred for purposes of this case.
Did everything that was in the record in Florida get moved to D.C.? I was under the impression that maybe some things hadn't, and that was part of the problem.
I don't
like the original complaint.
I can't give you a good answer to that question. All I know is that the docket in the record was supposed to have been transferred from the Northern District of Florida. It would appear that some of the magistrates' findings may not have been transferred. It would appear that certain other sort of ministerial things were not transferred. We did not include the district court in Florida's original determination simply because it wasn't really pertinent to any of the issues in the case, and that was transferred. But it's not clear to me whether there was additional material. All we have is what wound up in the docket of this court.
Okay, Ms. Ando, you were also appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case. An excellent job, and we're grateful for your assistance.
Thank you very much.
We'll take a brief break while the next case, which is quite different, takes positions on the council table.